Let's talk a bunch of different topics.
How'd her career get there?
This is a podcast with Lauren Asghari.
This is the Lauren Asghari podcast, How'd Her Career Get There? And my guest today is Tracy Lawrence, who is the founder and CEO of the Lawrence Advisory. Welcome.
Thank you, Lauren. I'm glad to be here.
Excellent. So let's get started with, we'll start with present day and then we'll get in our time machine and go back a little bit. So give an overview for the audience. What is the Lawrence Advisory?
The Lawrence Advisory is a consulting firm. We're a boutique consulting firm that focuses on leadership development. So we do three primary things. We do executive recruiting, and we do organizational consulting. So that's everything from, you know, change management. We do diversity, equity, and inclusion work, just kind of general organizational advisory. And then we do leadership coaching. So I work as a C-suite executive coach, and I have a coaching team with other coaches with different areas of expertise.
I love it. We're definitely gonna get into that a little bit more because the leadership stuff and the executive recruiting and the organizational consulting and diversity, I mean, obviously all important key topics in today's workforce. So, but before we get to that, let's get in our time machine and go back a little bit. Talk about kind of your background, meaning where are you from? What were you like as a kid growing up? Only child, siblings? Give a little bit of context about where Tracy came from.
So I love that question. I am from Los Angeles, born and raised in Los Angeles, and I live here now. I've lived kind of other places throughout my adult life, but I live here now. Only child. As a kid. And, you know, I think what was important about growing up, so I'm African-American, my parents are of that generation. Both of my parents have college degrees. My mother had two master's degrees, which she obtained by age like 22. I mean, my mom was like very, very smart and ambitious, but they didn't have opportunities as Black Americans at the time. So I think I was kind of their hope. So when I was growing up, they prioritized education for me. I went to, you know, some of the better public schools here in Los Angeles. And as a kid, I think my personality was, you know, I was very focused on school, but I also was, I'm kind of an explorer, like I'm an adventurous type person, right? So as a kid, there were always, I was struck by FOMO, fear of missing out. I always wanted to do everything, you know, so I played instruments, I learned to play piano, but that wasn't enough. I wanted to take up another instrument. And then when I wanted to take more, my parents wouldn't pay for it. So I just went and learned on my own. So I played like four instruments and I did clubs and I did all kinds of stuff. When I was in high school, I developed an interest in journalism. And so by the time I graduated high school, I had done an internship at NBC. I had an internship where I wrote a weekly sports column for a local newspaper, and I knew nothing about sports at all. So I had to go find my friends, my guy friends that knew sports, and they'd tell me what to write. And I produced a TV news show on my, my high school had a cable television station. So I produced a news show. So I was really busy.
Yeah. Now, was all of that thirst for knowledge and thirst for activity, was that just natural to who you are? Were your parents encouraging of that? Did they kind of bring that out in you? Or was that just Tracy all the way?
And no, they didn't really encourage that. It's like they
expensive hobbies.
I just wanted to do well in school and like grow up and be a lawyer or something. And I it's just my personality. My father was kind of like that. So I do a lot of work with assessments. And I one of my favorite ones is the Enneagram. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I've heard about it probably, I'm not exaggerating, probably 12 times in the past like 3 months. But I'm not intricately familiar with like how it works now.
So there are 9 personality types, and without getting into too much detail. So my type is type 7. It's known as the Epicure. And it's just a personality type that's really interested in a lot of different things. And so there's never, you're just never, like, you have to work really hard to stay still, which I do. But everything I hear is like, that's fascinating. I'd like to learn more. So that's just my personality. And it's been very consistent throughout my life.
So let's take it from high school then and keep going. So you're producing TV show, local TV show, yes, in high school, right? You're involved in journalism, involved in a bunch of different things. What do you end up going to college? If you yeah, did, what did you study? And then where did you go from there?
Yeah, so I went to Stanford. And majored in economics. And what happened is that, so I always tell people that the through line of my career has been a strong interest in what motivates people to do the things that they do. I'm very interested in people, which was my primary interest in journalism, right? Like curiosity. And then as I learned about business, I became really interested in just business. I find it to be really interesting. So I kind of went to college thinking I was going to be a communications major. And then, of course, had trouble finding what my major is going to be because I was so interested in so many different things. I really love philosophy. And so I was like, I'm going to major in philosophy. And I met with my philosophy professor and he said, oh, so you want to major in philosophy? Well, if you major in philosophy, you'll never make any money, but then you'll know that money isn't important because you're a philosophy major. So I decided to major in economics. Right. That wasn't going to fly with me. So walked away from that. But I became interested in business. And at first it was like the business of broadcasting, the business of, you know, journalism. And I thought I'd be like a news producer or something like that. So I applied to business school, got into Harvard Business School. At that time, I think they still do this. I don't know if they do, but they said, okay, you're accepted, but we want you to go work for a couple of years before you come. So I did that. I worked for a couple of years at an accounting firm, mm-hmm, called Pricewaterhouse. It's now PwC. And I basically just like crunched numbers all day long in front of a computer. And it's like, I hated that job. I liked some of the people I work with, but I just hated the job.
I've known you. This is our first time, you know, meeting virtually. And yeah, I would have guessed that sitting in front of a computer staring at numbers would not be your sweet spot.
Yeah, it was pretty horrible.
Your energy jumps through the screen. So
yeah, it was pretty awful. And it was also, quite honestly, at the time, this is the 80s, and there weren't that many women there, and it was very sexist. Mm-hmm. You know, so you'd have people calling, you know, you'd do something and someone would say, good girl. And I'm like, I just got into Harvard Business School. You got to be freaking kidding me. So it was just like offensive on top of that. So anyway, but I did learn financial analysis, which is important to understand for business. And I went to business school, learned about marketing and advertising. And that kind of was that sweet spot for me again, about how do you motivate people to do things and also, you know, deliver business results. Mm-hmm. So I just kind of developed this passion for marketing. I went into marketing after graduation, went to work at the time it was Kraft General Foods. Now it's just Kraft. Mm-hmm. And did brand management. So brand management's pretty cool. You know, after school, you're like 25 and they hand you $100 million business and you're running the P&L and, you know, you're responsible for advertising, pricing that product, you know, driving sales, all that kind of stuff. So I learned a lot about business that way, but then I got bored. See, you're getting to know me. I got bored. The businesses are just so large and they didn't change that much. So I stayed in brand management maybe 3 or 4 years, long enough to learn stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I quit my job. And at that time, I left General Foods and I was at Nestle working on chocolate businesses and just didn't like it. I didn't like it.
How old-ish are you at this point when you're at Nestle?
Late 20s. Okay. Yeah. Late 20s. And I literally just walked out one day and I just was like, I'll find something else that I'm more interested in. And at the time, this is before like the internet was really broad, you know, broadly usable. And so I would just like go to the library and I'd sit in the library all day and just read different stuff. Mm-hmm. And I saw an ad in the back of a magazine that said MTV was looking for marketing people. And I thought, well, that sounds like a lot of fun. So I sent my resume in. I think they got like 2,000-3,000 applications and I got an interview and I got the job. So that's how I ended up in the entertainment industry.
And what were you doing for MTV?
So I was a regional marketing person and I was working with sales. So this would have been, now we're in the 90s. Mm-hmm. So that was when cable TV was exploding. And so it was really big and MTV was really, you know, a hot brand at the time. Mm-hmm. There's a group on Facebook called I Worked at MTV When Working at MTV Was Cool.
I remember I didn't have cable until might have been like in high school for me. I remember going over to my friend's house all the time or being like, oh, can you tape the MTV Video Music Awards? Because we didn't have cable, but it was like such a thing.
It was a very cool job. I stayed there the longest I've ever stayed any place. And so MTV owns, you know, it's all Viacom. And so there was MTV, Nickelodeon, VH1, Comedy Central, all these networks, and they're all growing. And so I ended up working primarily with Nickelodeon. So I was there for 9 years and kind of rose up the ranks in marketing. And, you know, it was just fun. It was a lot of fun. There was something new going on every year, new businesses to grow. And I kind of developed this expertise in launching new television networks, which is also, you know, kind of consistent with my personality that I like change and new things. And so I did that. And then my boss, who was at the time at Nickelodeon, left. And he went and became the CEO of a company called Fox Family Worldwide. Now, this was a joint venture between Fox and a self-made billionaire named Haim Saban, who made a lot of his money launching the Power Rangers kids, right?
Yeah.
So he bought this television network and turned it into a kids and family network. And my old boss became CEO of that business. And after about a year, he brought me over and I was working on launching some new networks. And then eventually I became the general manager of that television network. Right.
And yeah. And so how do we get from, and I'm making notes as you're talking, so I have three or four things that you talked about that I want to pop back to, but how do we get from, big business, corporate America, right? I mean, the companies that you're talking about are global, well-known companies, to starting your own business.
So throughout this process, I felt like I was a pretty good manager. I really liked the people aspect of, you know, kind of this question of, okay, you have a business goal, but you need people to achieve it. And I could really see how the people and who they were affected how business was executed. So for example, when I went to Fox Family, that was not, even though it was a joint venture, it was an independently owned business. And so I could see, you know, my old boss and other people who'd come from larger corporations, and now you're at a more entrepreneurial place. And old behaviors don't necessarily work in that environment. And it was just really interesting to me, you know, because I could see it unfolding. And so eventually that network was sold to Disney. And I was trying to figure out what else, you know, so they put their own leadership team in. And I was kind of trying to figure out what else to do. And I was interviewing for a job at the time, which was, it was actually chief marketing officer at Yahoo, their entertainment division. Mm-hmm. And I got really far along. It was between me and one other person. The other person got the job. But the recruiting firm that was repping that job offered me a job. because at that point I'd gone through like 15 different interviews and I'd gotten to know everybody at the recruiting firm. And so they offered me a job to lead entertainment out of Los Angeles for them. And I had never, ever thought about doing that. But again, I'm like, I'll try it. Why not? It sounded kind of interesting. And I was kind of getting tired of the marketing thing. Because at this point, I'd done it for over a decade. And I just felt like how much more, I just didn't want to be continuing to do the same thing.
Sure.
So I did that with them. And I worked there for just a couple of years. And then I left. I spun off. And started my own, you know, one of the issues I had with, like, that I still have with some of the bigger recruiting, you know, they have these global recruiting firms.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And one of the issues I had with them is they're just so big that they can't always tailor what they're doing to the client. And also, you know, the way that works is you go find, they're looking for, you know, a president of whatever, some job, they place them and then you walk away and you don't really know what happened to that person. And so my own vision was more like, I wanted to create this model where you could actually stay with the client and have, you know, there's this phrase, trusted advisor, where you are really the person that they go to and you're their partner. Yep. And so I started my business doing, you know, recruiting, but I also went back and got trained as a coach. And it just kind of naturally started happening that because of, I have a lot of work experience, obviously.
Yeah.
And I was pretty well known in the entertainment industry at that point. So I started out working, you know, with entertainment people. And, you know, I just developed this model where, yeah, I just am with the organization and I have a lot of clients that, I have clients that I've been with for more than 10 years now that, you know, so they know that I know them. I know their business. I may do a recruiting project for them, but we also may, you know, do some organizational work as well.
Right. Gotcha. Yeah. And how long have you been running your business?
So I've had this business for 13 years now.
Gotcha. Wonderful. Yeah. I'm smiling. We're going to get to some recruiting stuff later. We don't do executive search, but my primary business is, as people say contract, I like to say consultant work, but primarily with technology and creative professionals. So we do more project staffing work, but totally familiar with the recruiting space in general. I mean, it's literally where I've spent my entire career. So I appreciate and understand everything that you're talking about. I want to bounce back to a couple of things that you talked about earlier, and then we'll talk a little bit more about the recruiting stuff. But something that looks consistent from the outsider, right, about you historically is, you know, Stanford, Harvard Business School, Kraft, you know, MTV, right? These are iconic brands in. You know, in the world and certainly in America. At any point, talk about whether in your personal experience, and if you didn't have it, then that's great and just in general, but was there ever any level of imposter syndrome or any level of, am I in the, should I be here or not? Or was it all very like, nope, I'm smart enough, I'm good enough, I'm capable enough, boom, 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 this is the next thing. Talk a little bit about that.
No, of course. I mean, I'm a Black woman. So, you know, when I went to Harvard Business School, the year that I graduated, there were, I don't know, 800 something people who graduated that year. Only 9 Black women graduated that year. And I think of Black people in general, it was maybe 40. So, you know, you're taking classes in your first year in business school, you have what's known as a section. So it's basically around 80 or 90 people, and you sit in one place all day long, and the professors rotate in and out. And I was the only Black woman in my class, in my section. So everybody knew who I was before I knew who anybody else was. Right. And so, yeah, I mean, a lot of the things that I did, I was the only or the first. You know, when I became general manager of television network, you know, there were maybe one or two other people that had jobs like that. Mm-hmm. So you know, yeah, there's a lack of role models. There's also a lack of anyone to tell you how things really work.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, and that's partly why I really enjoy what I do now, is because I can help others figure out what I didn't know. And it, sometimes it's really striking to me that I still talk to women and people from marginalized groups who are still having the same struggles that I had a long time ago.
Well, so, I very much appreciate your candidness with the answer, because one of the reasons that I started this podcast was really because as a female, in a lot of rooms, I felt like the one or the only, and I didn't, and it is different. At the core, we're all human, right? The most important thing, but there are nuances and differences, and even, you know, in how a female might communicate versus a male and how people receive it or not, right? And you can put that in any category of any different group of people. So one of the reasons I started this podcast was because I wanted to talk with other women for them to be able to share their stories, just as you so beautifully did, to give guidance to people that are the one or the first or the only in the room, and how you navigated that. What would you say to people now who maybe are still in the same, and also actually to double down on that point, you know, I think historically, sometimes we lose the fact that, you know, even where we are today compared to where we were, you know, it takes people and generation to open the doors, right? And to invite other people in and to the table and helping to make sure that people have their voices heard. And I think that sometimes we take that for granted, like even, you know, we're two women business owners, right? That wasn't always easy for generations before us. And then you add, you know, race on top of that, and it doubles down what maybe wasn't easier for generations before us. So what advice do you have for people nowadays that still might be the only or the first in the room?
So I do a lot of work with young people coming up. So for example, one of the things my firm does is we run a program for the Emma Bowen Foundation, which is a nonprofit that gives, you know, there's a whole application process, but if you are accepted, it's for students of color, college students of color who are interested in going into entertainment. So they give them, they get them summer internships every summer while they're in college. And we run a program for those students when they're seniors to help them. We work, stay with them all year and help them with their job search. And so we do a lot of, I do a lot of group work. I've done a lot of kind of like group coaching, that kind of thing. And one of the pieces of advice that I always give people is, yeah, the imposter syndrome is real. So one of the things you tend to see is people not wanting to be assertive, or people worrying about, like, I had somebody ask me recently, well, how do I ask for what I want without overstepping my bounds? And I'm like, well, the problem is your question, that you think that you could overstep, you know, your bounds. When I became a recruiter at the large global recruiting firm that I worked at first, and I was doing high profile searches, and I made an assumption that a lot of my friends who were people of color or just people from marginalized groups, I thought, oh my God, I'm going to be bombarded with people calling me asking, thinking I can get them a job. And what actually happened was that I was bombarded with white men who I knew, who I had no idea were as aggressive as they are. I'm not like that. Nobody I knew was like that, but they were just so naturally assertive. And don't get me wrong, there's nothing wrong with them doing that. And, you know, for the most part, I was fine with the interaction, but I was shocked that they were like four times more aggressive than the women that I knew and the people of color that I knew, like mm-hmm. four times, mm-hmm. you know? And it was so eye-opening to me, because it made me look at my own life differently and how many opportunities I probably hadn't taken advantage of because of that imposter syndrome, and because you just don't know how the world really works, because mm-hmm. there's nobody to tell you. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we always tell the students that we work with is college is very different from the real world. So when you're in college, you study the same way as a person next to you. And if you do your work, you can get an A just like that person. But when you're out in the working world, the criteria for who's successful or not is much more nebulous. Mm-hmm. And you may not even know. It's more like, you know, it's like the Squid Game. Remember that TV show that, mm-hmm. right? It's like, you don't know what the rules are until you're in the middle of it and you're dead because you messed up, right? And it's more that kind of thing. So you have to really make sure that you have people around you who will tell you the truth. So I spend a lot of time as a coach. I've been in literally now thousands of confidential conversations where people talk about how they see someone else's performance. And I gave a presentation a couple of years ago to one of my clients on, you know, 360 feedback, and I pulled actual comments on feedback for white men and feedback for people of color. Mm-hmm. And you can compare it. And what you see is that for people of color, you get a lot more what's known as unactionable feedback. So I'm not sure they're committed. I don't, you know, there are comments about style. There are comments about motivation. There are all these things about the person that there's nothing that you can do with that feedback, right? Whereas for a white man, they tend to get more concrete feedback. Mm-hmm. Right? And then the other thing is that the feedback for marginalized people is not, it's not always candid. So people feel uncomfortable giving a person of color feedback. And so sometimes you just don't get it. Mm-hmm. Right. And so you really are, you're playing a game where the rules are not obvious to you. So you have to find a way to figure out what the rules are. Right.
And what is that? Taking that a step further. I mean, is that being assertive? Is that giving yourself permission or not waiting for someone else to give you permission? How do you get that information if it's not readily accessible to you?
You have to talk to people that you're working with. So you may have to establish relationships with people who you may not have thought about talking to before. So you need to find people who are going to tell you the truth. And people who are going to tell you the truth can be at all different levels. It could be an assistant who sees all the communication going on, right? And watches things from a different perspective. It could be a really senior level person who can be a mentor or a sponsor to you. It could be other peers. So you just want to be out there talking to people, as opposed to what a lot of people do when they graduate college, especially if they've been successful, is they just keep doing the same things that made them successful in the past. So they sit in their desk and they do their work and they do a great job and they think doing a great job is enough. But it's not enough mm-hmm. when you're out in the working world, right? You have to do a great job. But, you know, I've seen a lot of, you know, women, people from marginalized groups who will say, well, I'm the best lawyer here, but I keep getting passed over for promotion. And that's because they're not. And you also hear people say, I don't play the politics game. Well, you know, you can decide not to play the politics game, but the politics game is happening. Mm-hmm. Right. And so you're going to lose. You're going to lose that game.
Right.
Yeah.
How important is it, in your opinion, for people to have an advocate or and I don't even want to say like a mentor within their company necessarily, but an advocate or somebody who supports them or their career?
It's very important to have, if you're working in a large company, what we know is that companies are what's known as sponsored meritocracies. So you have to do a good job. You have to have somebody who's influential who will say that you're doing a good job, because there are going to be rooms, and I've been in these rooms where they're all talking about who's going to get promoted. And someone has to say
your name.
Somebody has to really advocate for you. So that's a sponsor, somebody who's really going to put themselves on the line for you. So you do need a sponsor. You need mentors. I've heard people talk about having that personal board of directors, which is, you know, several people who bring something different to you. So you may have somebody who's more personally inspirational. You may have somebody who's going to tell you the hard truths. You know, you may have somebody who's been down that road before. So different people can offer different things.
And how I'm bouncing around here a little bit, but you're so intelligent, you're going to keep up. So what for going back to childhood a little bit, your parents, and it can be them together or independently. What's the one or two things that you learned from your parents that really stick with you and made you who you are today?
I think different things from my mother versus my father. So my father's family was from Jamaica. This is an immigrant family. And came here. My father, my grandmother, my father's mother came to the United States at age 16. She didn't know. She came to New York through Ellis Island. She didn't know many people. She literally had to go knocking door to door, asking people if she could clean their house. Like, that's what she did. My grandfather had a pawn shop, and he was kind of a serial entrepreneur. He always had all these different little businesses, haberdashery, you know, all these little businesses. They never made a lot of money, but he was just like very enterprising. And I think that that's been, you know, my dad always, even though my father was an electrical engineer, but, you know, he always had like an entrepreneurial spirit, right? Because mm-hmm. that's how he was raised. So I think, look, they were just really hustlers. And so I think I got that from them. And my father was very non-traditional. Like, he was more like my personality, like always trying different things. So he was an engineer, but he bought a sailboat when he was, you know, like when I was a kid, he just bought his first sailboat. So we would sail. So he was, you know, and he would always have like different hobbies and different things he would do. So I think I grew up with that open-mindedness and that sense of adventure from him.
I love that. I love that. What would you, I have a couple more questions here. What would you say, let's talk about the, I don't know if I'll call it the underbelly necessarily, but maybe the less glamorous side of, and you come with very interesting perspectives because you've seen both sides of big business and then running your own business. What's the not so glamorous side of each? And what's the best thing about them?
Yeah, business, big business is, I think, great, particularly when you're starting out, because you learn, there's so much to learn about how things are done. I think that you have to have a certain type of personality to want to work for a large organization for your whole life. There's a perception that it protects you from risk when you work for a large company. I question whether that's fully true because most people don't stay in their jobs longer than 3-4 years and then you're constantly looking for a new job. But I know a lot of people, most of my clients work at large companies and they, you know, they feel that there's stability there. So that's the good thing. But the downside is that, you know, you're a cog in a wheel.
Mm-hmm.
The entrepreneurial stuff is like the Wild West. Well, you know,
I know, Wild and I'm laughing because you can't even get the word entrepreneur out of your mouth without laughing. It's true. It is.
It's so crazy, and I love it. And my friends that you know, when you get entrepreneurs together, it's just it's hilarious. Some of it is like you're laughing to keep from crying, right? But you know it. When you start your own business, people ask me, well, how did you get the self-confidence to start your own business? And my answer is, I just didn't feel like I had a choice. I didn't want to work for a large company. It's not for me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember saying, oh my God, am I brave enough to do this? But I guess there is a certain amount of just, you know, I don't know if you call it bravery, but it is the Wild West. You're on your own. You eat what you kill. You're mm-hmm. responsible for it. When you hire people, it's interesting hiring people because I really like the people that work for me now. I really appreciate them. I think they're great.
Mm-hmm.
But I have hired people who didn't fully understand that, like, I'm not AT&T. And, you know, if you're working for me, you got to deliver. Mm-hmm. Like, it's my name. It is the Lawrence Advisory.
Well, and it's hard to hide in a smaller business, too. I mean,
you can't. And you have to, I mean, we get a lot of repeat business because we deliver really good work. Mm-hmm. And I do not tolerate not delivering good work.
there's this phrase, and I didn't say it. I heard it from Kevin Plank, who founded Under Armour, but it wasn't him, or maybe it was him that said it originally. I'm attributing it incorrectly somewhere, but it's trust is earned in drops and lost in buckets.
Yes. I love it. It's really true, right?
Yeah. So let's focus the last couple of minutes here on, I have one more final question, but before I get to that, let's talk a little bit about just kind of the job market and recruiting in general. What do you see now? What are some of the biggest challenges that you see companies having when it comes to recruiting, attracting, retaining talent?
Recruiting is in such a strange place right now because the economy is terrible, you know, in terms of all the layoffs and, you know, people are really worried. There's just this, you can feel the angst, but it's still hard to recruit good people. There's still a labor shortage. Mm-hmm. And so what I find in recruiting now is, for the last year, it's definitely been true that candidates just drop out of job searches, you know, because they got another offer. I had somebody today tell me that they're in advanced rounds with two other companies. And, you know, we try to advise clients, like, you have to really move fast. If you see somebody you like, you really have to move fast. It cannot be around, you know, clients sometimes still think that they're the ones making the selection. Mm-hmm. So they're going to sit back and interview 10 people and, you know, put people through 5 rounds. And, you know, no, you can't really do that in this market. You have to move. Mm-hmm. It's a tricky time in recruiting.
Yeah. That's the biggest piece. I would agree with you, is moving pace at which it moves. And it's for, you know, regardless, I'm knocking on wood or plastic, whatever's in front of me as I say this, but regardless of the overall economic situation, the top 10, 15, 20% talent pool remains happily employed.
Yeah.
And so absolutely. To get them, you've got to move them through the process quickly, right? People, candidates and employees, I mean, and employers, everybody wants to feel wanted, you know?
That's
so
right.
Waiting for a long time can make a candidate feel less than wanted, which, you know, whether it's ego or just human nature, can be problematic when trying to deliver them.
Absolutely. And you're also communicating something about who you are if it takes 3 months for somebody to go through your process, right? Mm-hmm.
Excellent.
They're thinking you're bureaucratic, slow. Yeah. So it's tricky.
Excellent point. Before I get to my last question, and then we have rapid fire, which is a series of random questions.
Okay.
Is there anything else that we didn't touch on that you would like to make sure that we talk about?
No, I think it's been great. No.
All right. My last question for you is, how do you define success?
I define success by professionally living a life that really represents my purpose in this world, right? So I see my business as very much an expression of who I am.
I love that. I love that. Succinct. I love that answer. All right, I'm going to go now into rapid fire. These are unrelated to anything that we've talked about so far. I've got, I don't know, maybe 6 of them. So just first thing that comes to mind.
Okay.
Stone or brick?
Stone.
Grass or sky?
Sky.
This one might be a little unfair. East Coast or West Coast?
West Coast. Are you kidding?
Moon or sun?
I would say moon.
Beach, like the sand, or ocean?
Beach.
And last one, astronaut or deep sea diver?
Deep sea diver.
All right.
Questions. I love that.
And where, Tracy, if people want to find you, get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
So probably LinkedIn, just Tracy L. Lawrence, or my website, which is thelawrenceadvisory.com.
All right. Perfect.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining. I really, really enjoyed our conversation. I wish that we had more time together, but maybe we'll do this again.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful day.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Let's talk a bunch of different topics.
How'd her career get there?
This is a podcast with Lauren Asghari.